Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 3rd of December 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio once again, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, we're going to get straight on because obviously in the last few days, the G20 has been taking place. Here is the family photograph. And as you can see there, Patrick, everybody is waving just about except for Theresa May and Macron. So maybe they were just sad about something. I think Macron will be coming on to the riots in Paris shortly. And of course, Theresa not so happy because of Brexit. But I guess neither of them was terribly interested in the G20. In fact, we'll see a little bit of that as we go here. So the G20 leaders gathering in Buenos Aires just before the weekend. And of course, the big issues were the US-China trade war, Russian aggression in Ukraine, and of course the killing of Mr. Khashoggi. Look, this conference was set up after the financial crisis in 2007-2008, and we've got, you know, Mr. Xi is there and Theresa May is there, lots of people there. They're all looking very happy. She got changed for this photograph and she seemed to prefer this costume for the event itself. But anyway, she was meeting lots of people. But the question is, what was Donald Trump up to? He met with President Xi for a dinner, and they both described it as a highly successful meeting. The White House statement said this was an amazing and productive meeting with unlimited possibilities for both the United States and China. It's my great honor to be working with President Xi. So that's what the statement said that Trump had said. The statement went on to say President Trump has agreed that on the 1st of January, he will leave the tariffs on $200 billion worth of products at 10% rate and not raise it to 25% at this time. China will agree to purchase a not yet agreed upon but very substantial amount of agricultural, energy, industrial and other products from the United States to reduce the trade imbalance between the two countries. China has agreed to start purchasing agricultural products from American farmers immediately, and they've agreed to immediately begin negotiations on structural changes with respect to forced technology transfer, intellectual property protection, non-tariff barriers, cyber intrusions and cyber theft, services and agriculture. So it's certainly, Patrick, being presented as a very productive, positive meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. If you look at the trade between the United States and China, there's obviously the U.S. has a huge trade deficit with China. But, Mike, this isn't necessarily because the U.S. doesn't have things to sell to China. There's a number of items that are on the sort of dual use list. You mentioned a few of those key areas, Mike, technology transfer, intellectual property concerns. Because there are so many restrictions, Mike, between the U.S. and China, that's why, one of the reasons why the U.S. has such a massive trade deficit with China. It's not for a lack of exportable product. So it's really up to the U.S. how they classify some of these items in terms of trade.
Trump and Xi met. It seems to have gone very well. Trump did meet President Putin as well, but we'll come on to that shortly. In the meantime, Xi, Putin and Modi, according to China Daily here, have agreed to increase trilateral cooperation. So the RIC, basically the BRICS, because Brazil, I guess Brazil with their new government, has more or less dropped out of BRICS.
There's some issues with Brazil. You have a right-wing government in power right now, but it's hugely under the influence of the United States now in terms of the U.S. Business class, the super class. So we're talking about transnational corporations, the Koch brothers, etc. So they, definitely the U.S. and one of the reasons why America worked so hard to put this government in Brazil behind the scenes for a number of years is exactly this, Mike. To try to peel Brazil away from that center of influence in Eurasia and pull Brazil westward. So that's a big blow for the BRICS, Mike. But at the end of the day, it follows a consistent pattern of regional economic blocks, regional diplomatic alliances. This is the direction the world is heading. This is the direction definitely the United States under this president is taking it away from the liberal world order that we saw in previous decades.
Just to say what Putin said here, I'd like to note that Russia, India and China are linked by old century-long friendly relations, which we are building based on the principles of good neighbourly relations, equality of rights and mutual confidence. The discussions were really productive. One of the results was, he's talking about the past, one of the results was the creation of the BRICS. But we believe that the RIC format has large prospects and the cooperation in this trilateral format may become effective supplementation to cooperation, which our countries carry out bilaterally and in the BRICS. Now, that term trilateral, of course, hints at what you were just talking about with the regionalization of economic blocs.
Sure, but it's also a slight to Henry Kissinger and the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, Mike, because obviously the Trilateral Commission was part of their life's work, if you will. And one of the reasons for this, Mike, was to manage a balance of power for the United States, especially in the Pacific Rim area. And so Russia, India, China have taken a feather out of the United States' previous establishment's cap to form their own trilateral bloc. So I'm not sure if Kissinger's too happy about that.
Well, of course, this meeting did not happen in the formal sense. This image is from another time. Putin had said it was unfortunate that we can't hold a full format meeting, referring to a meeting with Donald Trump. I hope that the meeting takes place eventually when the US side is ready for it. He said we don't set any preconditions because the issues we need to discuss are very important for us and for the rest of the world. Issues of strategic stability are on the top of the agenda, meaning that they're followed by questions of non-proliferation, of weapons of mass destruction. It's unfortunate we can't hold a full format meeting. I think it's very much needed in connection with issues of strategic stability, especially after President Trump announced that the United States plans to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And this was echoed by Dmitry Peskov. I'll come back onto that in a second. But he was also backing that up as well. Now, this issue of the Intermediate Range Weapons Treaty.
The INF Treaty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is one that Russians take very seriously. I do apologize. I've got this slightly out of order. So we'll just mention, of course, that Trump did not get to meet with Putin because apparently the issue of Michael Cohen hit the news immediately before the G20 summit. And, of course, we were hinting at the fact that perhaps this is why Trump called off this meeting. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
No, I think the main reason Trump called off the meeting, Mike, was pressure that is put to bear on him by the media, by the political establishment in the United States about the cursed crisis last week. So the fact that that Russia still has the Ukrainian military vessels impounded and people have been incarcerated for longer than in the United States was deemed acceptable, as it were. So that was an excuse to do exactly, and I think, Mike, that's exactly what the Kerch Strait incident was designed to do. Was one of the reasons the outcomes for that was to pull Trump and Putin apart, in other words, to maintain tension between the United States and Russia. So they definitely, Poroshenko or whoever is behind the planned provocation, which by all accounts it's planned provocation. If you just look at the series of events that preceded it and also what happened after that, it seems to be self-evident. That was the main objective.
Right. Well, getting back onto the INF Treaty then, this is Anatoly Antonov, who, of course, is the Russian ambassador to the United States. And he was speaking in the U.S. over the weekend and echoing Putin's comments here. So this is what he had to say today. One can hear opinions that nothing will happen if the U.S. abandons the INF Treaty. I don't think it would be accurate to paint such a rosy picture. He's clearly got the Russian establishment clearly has issues with what Trump has done here. He went on to say, I don't think it would be accurate to paint such a rosy picture. Denunciation of treaties or conventions has never led to the strengthening of international security, be it the ABM treaty or others. As for the response to the US withdrawal from the ABM treaty on March 1st, 2018, Mr. Putin announced a new weapons system which Russia has been forced to develop in order to maintain strategic balance. We warned our American colleagues about this back in 2004. Mm-hmm. And the problem here is, Patrick, isn't it, that of course somebody takes some action, the other party takes action in response to that, and then somebody starts blaming the other party for being aggressive in their approach. Russia can't really win here as far as the Western media and politicians are concerned.
Well, this dialectic that's being created here, driven mainly by the United States' desire to break various international agreements, Mike, it's not designed for a winner, Mike. I think what you're looking at here is the United States are trying to recreate the mutually assured destruction narrative that was so successful under the Cold War. That was the kind of the scientific or scientistic ideological backing of the Cold War, and it served so many war planners and strategists so well, and it served the arms race incredibly well, the defense industry, for so many years. So they're trying to put that back to the forefront, because mutually assured destruction, well, there's a lot of things that go along with that, Mike. That you can leverage and take advantage of in terms of creating a kind of a bipolar dialectic globally. So that's what I think is part of this, Mike. It's a return of MAD.
A return of MAD, which, of course, enables you to politically get away with spending more money on military-industrial matters.
And that seems exactly what the Trump administration has been doing. It's on its face, Mike. The evidence is pretty obvious. Look at the budget now in real terms, over $1 trillion a year. So a huge budget increase in terms of the defense in the United States. You'll see more, by the way, next year.
And how sustainable is that?
It's very sustainable, Mike, because we have a thing in the United States called the Federal Reserve Bank, which is neither federal nor does it have any reserves in it, but it's a fantastic printing press. One of the greatest printing presses of all time, in fact. So, yes, we can go up to $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion if need be. It doesn't matter. But most of that is pork wastage, Mike. Just look at the F-35 project, and you'll know it does cost $5,000 for a hammer and $2,000 for a nail in the United States military-industrial complex.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, we mentioned Paris, so let's move on to Paris. What has been going on over the weekend?
Well, as you can see here, if you haven't been following the news, I'm sure everybody has, but the high-vis, the revenge of the high-vis jackets are underway in Paris. They're protesting on fuel tax and duties and other rising prices, and the standard of living is dropping for a lot of people in France. That's what they're up in arms about. And, of course, Emmanuel Macron is now weighing, Mike, here about instituting a state of emergency. This isn't unusual in France, Mike. They've done this with some of these so-called terrorist attacks in France over the years. They've instituted the state of emergency. So I think it's hugely interesting what's going on in France, Mike. Some of these scenes look slightly Maidan-ish, but I would say it's Maidan light in the fact that everyone's wearing a high-vis jacket. So in terms of health and safety, Mike, it's absolutely a kosher protest from a health and safety point of view. Everyone's got a high-vis jacket on, which I think is great.
But this is the tale of two protests.
This is the tale of two protests, and this is an interesting narrative, Mike. So here we are in Paris with the yellow jackets, they call them, and they are really raising hell right now in France and doing a pretty good job of it. And our hats off to, this is in the great French tradition of the manifestation. So I think it's really fantastic. That's real democracy in action, depending on who you talk to anyway. And this is another protest that France was backing for many years. These are the Free Syrian Army moderate rebels in Syria. So this is a bit of a conundrum, a bit of a quandary for Emmanuel Macron, Mike, because these are illegitimate protests, and these people are akin, he didn't use this as exact language, but pretty close to calling them domestic terrorists.
So the protesters in Paris are illegitimate protests, and they are domestic terrorists, pretty close to.
Yeah, domestic terrorists, but wearing high-vis jackets again, so complying with health and safety. Now, but here in Syria, these were peaceful protesters who had legitimate democratic aspirations, although they have tow missiles here and Kalashnikovs, and they do do suicide bombs and do all sorts of things on camera that we can't even talk about because they're so horrible. Those are the moderate rebels in Syria. Emmanuel Macron, Francois Hollande before him, they were all in for these guys, as was Nicolas Sarkozy. So we, for Manu, the question is, qu'est-ce que c'est, Manu? Which is it? Which ones peaceful? Which ones are legitimate democratic protesters? So France armed the moderate rebels, Mike, and they bombed Syria. So I think in this case, Emmanuel Macron, to be consistent, will have to bomb his own country and supply traffic weapons to the high-vis jacket protesters. That would be fair. Then we'd have reciprocity in this equation.
At least a consistent policy.
Consistency. And that's really what we're looking for in the EU in terms of politics, more consistency. So they should traffic weapons and fire cruise missiles at Paris if they really want to be consistent.
Okay. What has Faris Shahabi been saying about this?
Well, this is the Aleppo independent MP, and he's also head of the Chamber of Business and Industry in Aleppo. And he's saying that despite all evil doings of the French governments against Syria since 2011, this is Paris today, and sees pictures of the fires, tires or whatever is burning there by the Arc de Triomphe. And he's saying, and this is Damascus today, and you see the opposite image with the blue lower third there, and it's peaceful. And so he's saying, karma. We really wish no one messes with France's stability in the same way that France did to us. A tale of two uprisings. Looks pretty good in Damascus right now, not so good in Paris, Mike.
Yes. Okay, now, yesterday, of course, was AV9.1, and Ian R. Crane pushed this tweet out today. Packed house at AV9.1, listening to Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire sharing his research and insight into the role of the UK establishment in global manipulation. No conspiracy, just facts. Mm. So how was the event?
It was a great event. It was a sold-out event. They had to bring in extra seats, actually, Mike, which is always a good sign. So a great job, of course, by the great event organizer, Ian R. Crane. But some stunning presentations from Alex Thompson, UK column. Of course, Brian Gerrish, great presentation by Brian. And a really moving presentation by Dr. Graham Downing on the issue of vaccines. And also the partner of David Noakes, who received his sentence last week. Lynn gave a really emotional appeal, and it was an unforgettable event. And I have to say, one of the most powerful sort of one-day events that I've seen in a long time. So our hats off to Ian R. Crane and all the people who participated. And, of course, the most important thing were the people who came to that event. Some wonderful people, Mike. It just never amazes us to see how many fantastic people there are out there that are really getting behind some of these issues and really supporting some of the people who need it the most. So we thank everybody who attended.
So you were, amongst other things, discussing the Integrity Initiative, is that correct?
I did. I touched on the Integrity Initiative, and the theme of my talk, Mike, was it was about democracy and change. That was the theme of the event, but I was asking the question, do we have real democracy or do we have corporatism? Mm. Because if we have corporatism, the emergence of government, state and corporate interests, that by definition is fascism, if you go by the orthodox definition by Benito Mussolini himself. So that was what the case I was laying out. Integrity, Mike, obviously is a big piece of evidence.
Yes.
To show this network that involves the state, think tanks, the military, and the mainstream media, Mike, and other various quangos working together in a clandestine network. They say to fight disinformation from Russia, but if you actually look into it as we have, Mike, they're actually disseminating disinformation and running smear campaigns against individuals, even against other independent journalists like ourselves.
Well, indeed, that is the argument that I make in an article we posted on the UK Column website, Integrity Initiative. I look into the deep state. I would just ask everybody that's watching, listening, to read that article and get it spread around as widely as possible. This is our first go at this subject. There will be much more coming from us. And the image there, of course, is David Scott's image of Gateside Mills. Now, one mainstream outlet has now picked up on this Gateside Mills issue, the fact that that Integrity Initiative and the Institute for Statecraft, the think tank behind it, seems to have been misleading the authorities on where they are and where they exist. But anyway, what I wanted to highlight here was the Russian statement on this, because the Russians have now made a comment on the Integrity Initiative situation. We're aware of the publication regarding the activities of this structure. They show that it's been partially funded by the British government, and the number of programs in sovereign European states aimed at demonization of Russia have been listed in this framework. The embassy has sent an official request to the Foreign Commonwealth Office asking them to confirm or deny the authenticity of the published documents and to provide information on current and planned projects on Russia funded by the FCO. Of course, it would be premature to make conclusions before an official response from the British authorities is received. However, at this point, close scrutiny of the documents published leads to a conclusion that the activities in the framework of this project amount to a massive disinformation campaign against Russia. I think that is a pretty fair statement under the circumstances.
It is. If you actually look and you examine what's there, Mike, and you look at some of the output of this group, particularly taking out ministerial appointments in Spain with a matter of hours by mobilizing this network, Mike, it is definitely exactly as the Russian embassy has described. Of course, there are people who are not going to like that. How dare you agree with the Russian embassy, any statements they make, because that's automatically Kremlin propaganda, of course. At least that's what we're conditioned by the mainstream press. And ironically, Mike, the reason we're conditioned by the mainstream press is because of the very project which they're describing in the statement. You can't make it up.
Well, exactly. Well, let's look at some of the stuff that has appeared in the media. We're going to start off with The Hill here. Trump, Russia, and lessons from the mob. Did Godfather's Steyr collusion probe? So this is John Solomon, and he's talking about what could be described as a sting operation. So he's saying that the Russia probe against Trump was the result of an operation conducted by Britain, Australia, and the FBI. He says, early in my reporting that unraveled the origins of the Trump-Russia collusion probe, tying it to Hillary Clinton's campaign and possible Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act abuses, I started to see patterns, just as in the old mob meetings. FBI or intelligence-connected figures kept showing up in Trump Town, USA, during the 2016 campaign with a common calling card. And he mentions various figures, including Christopher Steele, Felix Sater, and so on. We're going to come on to that in a second. And he said there are others that he had identified, but US officials have asked him to keep a shield on their identities to avoid compromising their identities or nexus to intelligence and law enforcement work. And he says that the chances that so many would converge into then-candidate Donald Trump's circle in such a short period of time around an election are about as rare as winning the Mega Millions lottery. In other words, most were not coincidences, a few maybe, but not all. So he has a point, and we've got to make the point once again that Western politicians and the Western media are driving this narrative that it is Russia which is interfering in election campaigns. The Integrity Initiative documentation has shown at least one case in Spain where Western intelligence services and Western media and Western politicians have driven a campaign to make sure somebody could not be put in an official position because they didn't like his Russian
sympathies.
Yes. Mm. Here we have, well, what is this? UK, Australian intelligence services plus the FBI interfering in the US election?
It doesn't just look like that, Mike. That's exactly what's happened. And I think let's just lay this out for you. Let's look at all the Queen's men here. We've got, of course, Christopher Steele, the former, I use that in single quotes, MI6 agent. And, of course, one of the authors of the fake Trump dossier. And, of course, depending on what side of this issue you're on, Mike, how dare he say it's fake? Well, it is fake. There's a number of pieces of misinformation in this dossier. It's already been roundly discredited. Christopher Steele is one of the main people behind it. Who is he really working for and on behalf of who? This is a good question, but he was paid, Mike, a lot of money.
Yes.
So the fact that he was paid a lot of money to tart up a fake dossier really speaks volumes on its own. And of course, we have Stefan Halper. He has been a deep state operative for decades, Mike. This goes right back to the Reagan administration. So this is a British, he's now a British academic, but with a very close ties to the CIA, the FBI, and formerly with MI6. Is Stefan Halper a double agent? Quite likely, Mike, that he is. But he was also sent in to do some dirty work during the Reagan years as a younger upstart operative. And very interesting bit of business that he was dealing with during the 80s, right in the center of the Iran-Contra affair and also the Reagan administration. A lot of interesting stuff going on there. We'll talk more about that in the future, perhaps. And here's Alexander Downer. Mike, this is the really interesting character here, Australian diplomat, effectively a leading Australian intelligence figure for many years, although he will deny that he is really a spook, and he'll say that, well, I'm just a diplomat. Well, the history, and if you do some cursory research on Alexander Downer, or Lexi, as he's known in Australia, you'll find he's very well connected, and he's been connected to a lot of very controversial things over the years. And we'll tell you exactly how he fits into this. Joseph Mifsud, is he MI6? Is he a CIA asset? It's difficult to know, but he's the gray man who is in the background, who has brought this story to the fore. We'll explain how in a minute. And of course, you have Richard Dearlove here, former head of MI6, and now one of the directors, I believe, of Orbis.
He was a founder of Orbis.
Orbis Intelligence
yeah,
Limited.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So who else works for Orbis, by the way? That's a familiar name,
Mike. I think
Mike.
It was the first person on your list there, Christopher Steele.
Pablo Miller, perhaps.
Pablo Miller, yes. Which, of course, links us to Skripal.
Sergei Skripal. Was Skripal working for Orbis, I wonder? It's possible. And was he working on the fake Trump dossier? Well, we'll never know until we get a chance to speak to Sergei Skripal.
Where is he, by the way?
No one has seen him for quite a long time, and nor his daughter either. I'd be very worried if I was their family. So these are all the Queen's men, Mike. There they are, set up right there. And their whole job there is really, I'll prove to you, is to nail the man on the bottom, which is Donald J. Trump. But there's another actor that's come in here, Felix Sater. Who is Felix Sater? Well, he's come in the frame just this week with regards to Michael Cohen, Trump's disgraced attorney, who apparently had to lie to get a plea bargain. So that's what happened. And this idea that Trump was working on a real estate project in Russia before 2016 or during 2016, and somehow that amounts to collusion. Well, who is Felix Sater? An FBI informant, a CIA informant. He was imprisoned for doing some very violent stuff and also running a $40 million fraud scheme. Involving, I believe, Russian oligarchs, and he was then had to turn and become an FBI informant at that point. He was also a business associate, a tertiary with Trump on property deals from, I believe, the mid-2000s. So he looks like a career FBI guy. So they're all aiming at POTUS, okay? But what's this really about? It's about this man. Who is this man? This is the key man. George Papadopoulos, former Trump advisor. Why is he the key man? He is just about to do his sentence. He had to plead guilty to a process crime under the Mueller investigation and nothing to do with collusion. They're claiming he lied to the Mueller investigation. All of these convictions or so-called convictions by the Mueller investigation, Mike, are people who have supposedly lied to the Mueller investigation. So without the Mueller investigation, there would be no crime because they haven't got anything near Russian collusion. They framed George Papadopoulos, and the framing of him by Alexei Downer and all of these operatives initiated the FISA warrants, which started the FBI campaign surveillance under President Obama during the elections. It was by framing Papadopoulos, getting the FBI to believe that he knew something about Hillary's emails that initiated these FISA warrants and caused a chain of events of illegal activity. This is what they do not want to become uncovered, Mike. And if those FISA warrants are declassified, then I think all bets are off, and I think this thing is going to blow up and go nuclear in terms of a scandal, Mike. So,
well, let's look at well, what could potentially be the work of the Integrity Initiative here. This is a fantastic article in the Mail Online, but actually this was the front page of the Daily Mail yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And the headline is, Russian TV spies are caught at top secret UK army base, how fake news team tried to infiltrate British psychological warfare unit. So a Russian TV crew was caught spying, Patrick? Was that what they were doing? Or were they making a report to camera?
No, the Mail takes it a step further, Mike. They've infiltrated the British military establishment by standing outside the fence and filming. That constitutes infiltration of British military by Russian spies. So they've made two leaps of logic here. One is that Russian media are all automatically spies. Well, we know this from the Times and other, what might be Integrity Initiative's planted stories,
yeah,
that half of the expats and Russians in the UK are spies. So they've done that jump. And then the next jump, of course, is the irony, Mike, is that Russia Channel 1 here is covering Brigade 77, which is the information warfare unit in the British military, which might be involved in some of these Integrity Initiative.
It is.
Okay. So I find that quite ironic. And now they're UK media spinning this. Is this an integrity story we're looking at with the Mail?
Well, that is my feeling. And particularly if you look at the comments, because I have to admit, as I read this story, it seemed so ridiculous to me, Patrick, that I figured, well, the people in the comments must appreciate how ridiculous it is. But actually, if you look at the comments, what have we got here? We've got comment after comment.
After Skripal, you shouldn't have let them in the country. You know, Border Force should do their job.
Yeah, exactly.
If a British reporter, Mike, was caught within 5 miles of a military base in Russia, we'd never see or hear from that person again. A Russian reporter is allowed to remain here and move freely instead of expelling him. Our military personnel are being instructed to avoid him. Unbelievable. Outrage.
And we've got one here where somebody makes a comment. So are these people journalists or are they not? Or are they spies? And they get the anti-Russian comment in response.
Yeah. So they aren't fake reporters. They just work for the Russian state TV. Confusing story. Russians don't have journalists. They are all spies.
They are all spies. This is the
narrative. Be aware.
Be aware.
So those are planted comments, clearly, because of the robotic nature. You can tell with just basic discourse analysis that you're looking at absolutely fake planted comments. I mean, can anyone actually make a debate that you read those comments that they're not, you know, put in there intentionally to make a political point? The style in which they're written, Mike, you'd have to be an absolute, you'd be very naive or you're putting a deceptive argument forward to say that those are all legitimate comments.
So before the Integrity Initiative hack and the release of the documents, it may have been difficult to look at that article. And, you know, we might have thought that perhaps this was a placed article, but the evidence of the Integrity Initiative and what that represents certainly leads one to believe that this is much more likely to be a placed article, and that therefore they have got people making comments to make sure that the comments support the article, because this does not look like the typical Daily Mail comment, in my opinion. If you look at the way that the comments have been going for the mainstream media, and the Daily Mail is included in that, over the last year or two, people are becoming significantly skeptical of this type of stuff. And suddenly we've got comments like that appearing.
So how this would work, Mike, according to the Integrity Initiative, is an alert would go out probably from the Atlantic Council or the DFR labs, their sort of propaganda adjunct, and who does the data trolling, I guess, for the Atlantic Council. And that would go out to the UK cluster, Mike. And the UK cluster then, which is comprised of journalists and other bureaucrats, think tank agents of influence, who have little troll groups or whatever, that alert goes out, and they maybe see this story on Russia One, Mike, and then all of a sudden it triggers, and then one of the journalists will pick it up, write a story about it, and then they'll hit Twitter and hit the comments to try to influence public opinion, and then maybe turn it back against Russia and smear the journalists and smear anybody involved. This is all right in their documents, Mike. We're not speculating at all here.
Absolutely.
This is exactly, this would be a job for their team of elves, they call them, like Santa and his little elves. The elves team, one of the elves teams would be activated to deal with this. So whenever you see a fake Russian story in the press, and I just gave a little small sample of 20 of them last night.
A small sample
of 20 fake Russian stories from the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian had so many. You could do a whole 8-hour presentation just on Guardian fake news. CNN, of course, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the usual. So you put that together with the Integrity Initiative, Mike, and my point was, what are we looking at here? We're looking at a disinformation influence campaign by this collective that's working in a clandestine fashion, is getting state funding from the UK, from the United States, from other funding sources, I would imagine. Said private funding sources. Who's paying for that? Is that, well, I don't want to say the S word, Soros? I don't know.
No.
It could be anybody.
Yes.
So.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to this one. Another Mail Online article. GCHQ spy chiefs admit they keep some cyber attacks secret to help them learn how hackers operate. So what they're basically saying is, well, we know that that there are zero-day attacks that are possible on certain systems. And sometimes when we discover these things, we tell the Microsoft or Apple or whoever it might be that these back doors or these doorways are available into the systems. But sometimes we don't bother because actually we want to keep those open, allegedly, so that we can learn how hackers operate. Mm. I don't think so.
And terrorists. Because terrorists must be ISIS who hacked Marriott, Mike, and stolen all the data of all the customers and breached all these big corporations, right? Must be ISIS. Be some guy in Raqqa with a battery of PCs, I guess. It has nothing to do with any state agencies in the West, would it? Or any hackers in the West who are maybe working part-time or doing other jobs for other state agencies? I don't know.
Who knows?
It's a murky world, isn't it?
It is, but it's pretty despicable that the government of the day would be encouraging illegal activity when it suits them. This is not how governments are supposed to work. But on the other hand, if we look at how this particular government has worked in the last, since 2010, we can see that they have been putting legislation in place to make the illegal activity of the British intelligence services over the last 40 years retrospectively legal, which of course they can't do, but they've done it with the various spooky legislation that they've created in the last couple of years. Mm. So they're attempting to justify this type of behavior, and it's not really justifiable.
If you could get somebody to perform, Mike, it's an IT question for you, a cyber question. If you can get someone to perform a big hack that results in a major data breach, we're talking about the details of hundreds of thousands of customers and personal data details. And then all of a sudden the government will spring into action with some piece of legislation or some new regulation or mandate some thing that would have financial implications in terms of adopting or raising the budgets of cybersecurity. Is this an out of the ordinary scenario? Is this something that, is that too much speculation?
No, because in fact we've just got a new cybersecurity center that's costing billions of pounds, haven't we?
So it's
just a coincidence.
It's something that's not out of the realms of possibility.
No, it isn't.
So I think.
Okay, well, look, let's leave it with this one because you spotted this last week and you drew it to my attention, but I thought we'd leave it for you coming into the program because you were so appalled by it.
So this story was put out by the BBC, Mike, a gushing, apologist story about this man sitting here, Christopher Blair, on his porch. Somewhere in New England, he is the godfather of fake news. Bear in mind what we just showed you about the Integrity Initiative, what we just showed you in terms of fake planted Russian stories in the Western mainstream press. And this is following this general theme of fighting and crusading against fake news online. And here you have one of the founders of the fake news movement, one of the people who placed all these fake stories, Mike, on Facebook, right here, meet one of the world's most prolific writers of disinformation. You'd think they'd go after him in this article, Mike. You'd think they'd really go in for the kill and really hold this guy to account for creating this huge crisis, I guess, in the establishment, which was used to blame Russia, ostensibly, right? You'd think that's how it would work. And here's some of his online personas. I am Busta Troll. There he is, looking like a kind of a Harley Davidson riding U.S. conservative patriot. He took on the personas of patriotic Americans, outraged at President Obama, at liberals, at feminists, at Black Lives Matter movements. And yes, a lot of people would be retweeting and sharing this content, Mike, online by this gentleman, Christopher Blair. And the BBC is explaining how he did this. And all of a sudden, the big reveal comes. But the frenetic political climate in America meant fake news writers like Blair were more successful than ever before. He hired other writers to churn out more fake stories. The money kept flowing in.
Yes.
He was making a fortune doing this, okay? And it turns out, Mike, Blair was a committed liberal Democrat, self-described liberal Democrat, votes Democrat, and he's posing as a conservative. His aim was to trick conservative Americans into sharing false news, thus creating the crisis in the hopes of showing what he calls their stupidity. The level of manipulation here, Mike, is breathtaking. And here he is with his little pug dog, French bulldog, this Christopher Blair. The mission with the trolling, first and foremost, is that we wanted to pull people into the comments and weeding out and reporting the most extreme users among his so-called fans. Hundreds of profiles we've had taken down, he said. We've had people fired from their jobs, he said. We've exposed them to their families. I'm very proud of my work, as the fake news godfather, says Christopher Blair. This is a glowing piece. They're heaping adulation, the BBC. At no point in this article did they say that the ethical problem with this, that they launched a whole crusade against fake news, and the guy who was one of the guys, main guys driving it, who was profiting on it here, was it from the Democratic Party. Okay, this is Big Brother. This is what Big Brother really looks like, folks. The entrapment, the deception. It's somebody like this. Literally, you know, so what can I say, Mike? That's the story of fake news, the real story of fake news.
Absolutely.
So between that and the Russians, it's all completely fabricated. Pretty much all of it. So,
okay, well, look, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today, Patrick. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday. We hope to see you then. Bye-bye.